Today on Maine Calling, how rising temperatures affect our lives. Maine is more associated with cold winters than hot summers, but the changing climate is affecting many aspects of our daily lives. I'm Keith Shortall, and today on the program, we'll share the findings of a collaborative reporting project between Maine Public and the Portland Press Herald. It explores the ways in which heat is making us rethink the way we work, go to school, and conserve the wildlife, plants, and other integral parts of our natural world. We'll also learn more about how high temperatures that start earlier in the year and last longer are affecting our agriculture and our economy. We'll talk with some of the journalists who spent months researching and reporting on the subject about their findings, and as always, we want to hear from you. Maine Calling is just ahead.
Maine Calling is made possible in part by Rennie's, a Maine shopping adventure with 19 locations across the state, now open in Bangor and Waterville, and by Maine Seacoast Mission, delivering health care, education, and support to islands and coastal Down East communities. Learn more at seacoastmission.org.
I'm Keith Shortall, and this is Maine Calling. There are some who may think that warming temperatures due to climate change aren't that big of a deal in Maine, maybe even a welcome change for a place that's historically known for its long winters and fleeting summers. But increasingly hot weather is having its effects here on humans, on the environment, and on the economy. It's the subject of a collaborative reporting effort between Maine Public and the Portland Press Herald, and today we talk with the team of journalists about their key findings from the series. Joining me by Maine Public colleague Molly Enking, climate editor with Maine Public Radio, Penelope Overton, climate reporter for the Portland Press Herald, and Rebecca Lincoln, environmental epidemiologist with the Maine Center for Disease Control and Prevention. Note that you can find the reporter's stories by going to mainepublic.org and searching for the series title, Heat in Maine. So here we are, early October. A weekend is coming, and we may have thoughts of changing leaves and maybe catching a football game in a sweater. But in actuality, the weather forecast predicts temperatures in the mid-70s and high temperatures for this time into the next week. And now, and we should point out that it's not new to have warm days in October, usually in the record books, but, you know, going back to 84 degrees that we saw recorded in 1947. But I think most of you will make a case today that the climate warming is happening in very specific ways, and you chronicled that in some of your work. Molly Enking, let's start with you. One of the great challenges about covering this topic, it seems to me, is that it's so big. I mean, there's this expression we use in the newsroom when a story is just too encompassing and poorly or hard to focus, which is we say we're trying to boil the ocean. And that's darkly appropriate here, I guess, as a phrase. But how do we cover, how do we get at this big story that doesn't really match up well with the daily news cycle?
Absolutely. I've been covering climate change for a while now. And when I started here at Maine Public, I did what I always do at a new job and sort of started writing down different aspects of my beat. And if you let yourself, covering climate change can cover pretty much every aspect of life. But for a project like this, we wanted to hone in on extreme heat. It's something that Mainers maybe don't think about. We're less accustomed to it and we're less prepared for it because we are a cold weather state. And not being prepared can leave people and infrastructure in our state vulnerable. You mentioned the temperatures this weekend. Climate change is making heat waves four times more likely in parts of Maine. The Maine Climate Office said in the course of our reporting for this project that summer temperatures in Maine have increased 3 degrees on average since the 50s. So climate change and global warming is happening. And at the same time, while that general warming is happening, we wanted to focus in on this issue of extreme heat and heat waves that are becoming more prevalent and more frequent in Maine.
Now, the idea for this series came from a conversation that happened at a journalism conference earlier this year. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so the Society for Environmental Journalists conference was in Phoenix this year. And Penny and I both attended. And I think I won't speak for you, Penny, but I was like, okay, I'm really going to have to work to find story ideas at this conference in the Southwest. You know, their climate is so much different than ours. There were a lot of panels about heat, and it got me thinking about, you know, increasing heat waves in Maine and how states like ours, other northern states like Washington, Minnesota, are preparing to handle this. And I came back looking through my notes and sort of looking around for this project that we ended up settling on. But I think the project was really Penny's idea, so I'll throw over to her.
Thanks for having us here. And I think that when we were out there, there were on those panels, there were a surprising number of what I would consider to be cold weather states like Maine that were there, that were presenting some of the ways that heat was playing out for them. Because there's really, I didn't see much of a story for us in the way that Phoenix was handling heat. I used to live in Phoenix, and I know how hot it can be. And so to me, the 115 degree days didn't seem like something that, you know, that had any kind of parallel here. But then when I was talking with reporters from, you know, the Milwaukee paper and people, the Seattle Times and other places, that they were like, wow, okay, but we're dealing with this here. And it kind of got the ball rolling about the idea of how we, our bodies, you know, in cold weather states are used to cooler temperatures. And so it doesn't take 115 degree like pavement melter day in Phoenix to affect us. But it was those nuggets when you're there, you're like, okay, so that's something that we should be paying closer attention to. And frankly, I haven't maybe been covering climate as long as Molly, but been doing it 2 years, and I have to admit, I fell into that trap of thinking that climate change in Maine was about sea level rise and extreme weather as far as, you know, the downpours and the flooding and the interior rivers. I did not, maybe because I still remember those days in Phoenix, I didn't think that Maine had a heat problem. And so it was an eye opener for me being out there hearing other cold weather states talking about this. And then when I got back, it kind of triggered something for me, because I was at a ClimateWorks conference here, like, you know, one of the things that we go cover for a daily story. And something that Dora Mills said when she was speaking about the thing that kept her up at night when she was the director of the CDC here in Maine. I'm forgetting the exact title, but the equivalent. She said it was heat waves. And I'm thinking, what's the CDC director staying up at night thinking about heat waves in Maine? Like, cold breaks, people freezing. I could have understood that. Like, and there's always a million things that get said at a conference like that, that you will, and you have to do a daily story. But that was a thread that I wanted to pull with her. So kind of cornered her outside the bathroom and asked her, you know, can you explain that? Like, do you just have a really low tolerance for things that keep you up at night? And she went on the feel that you will hear her give when she talks about this. And it was all about that idea that it doesn't take, you know, a 90 degree day to trigger people in Maine, where our bodies aren't physiologically prepared for it, and our built environment is meant to keep heat in, not out. So those two things together are the crystallizing things.
Yeah. So let's go to that issue then of heat as a public health problem. And Rebecca Lincoln, you're an epidemiologist, environmental epidemiologist at Maine CDC. So from where you sit, do we pay enough attention to heat as a public health issue, and if not, why?
Well, I think awareness is growing all the time, and we were thrilled to see this series of stories come out this summer because we, you know, I'm with Dora. This issue keeps me up at night, and it has for a while.
Same.
In the early days of working on extreme heat as a public health issue in Maine, I think we had a really hard time convincing people that this was something they should pay attention to and care about. It was something that they needed to be concerned about in the universe of other things that were on their minds for their health. And I think every summer that conversation gets easier to have. Every news story that comes out highlighting the ways in which regular Mainers are affected by the heat and, you know, the health impacts that we see, the groups that we're most concerned about, it really helps us do our work and convince people that there are real issues that we need to take seriously, even if we're not, you know, if we're not having the 115 degree scorchers like they are in Phoenix. We are more sensitive to the heat here, and we need to take it seriously.
And also, is it that we, I sort of think of like people in the South who don't know how to drive in snow, is it that we don't really think of, we're just not used to it? We don't know how to do living in heat up here as well?
This is a great question. I think some of it is that just lack of experience with how you go through a hot spell. But some of it is also physiological, and we know from a lot of research across the country and, you know, in different parts of the world that, like Penny said, cooler weather climates, we see bigger impacts in health for the same, you know, the same hotter temperatures. And it's about physical acclimation to the heat. It takes our bodies a while to ramp up. We see that every summer. The first heat wave of the summer is the one that has the biggest impact in terms of health. And it's because people's bodies are, you know, optimized right then for the cooler spring temperatures. In other parts of the country, we see the weather warm up more gradually. And, you know, everybody has a chance to get ready for the heat as it comes. In Maine, the way we've experienced these hot spells in the early summer is they come out of nowhere, and you know, people don't have air conditioners in their windows. People's bodies are used to 60s and 70s. We're coming out of the winter, and it can have a real significant impact on health just because of the physiological adaptation.
So it has to do with your blood.
Actually, the state runs a really interesting public health tracking system, and you can look at it. Anybody, you can hop on there. And I was living on that page for a while. It felt like the summer, but you'll see the first heat wave that we had, the June 24th period around there, 48 emergency room visits in one day. And then we had like probably, although the crazy thing is everybody defines a heat wave a little differently. But if you looked, that we had like three other kind of events this summer, and each time the number of ER visits declined, even though the temperature was at times high for even longer periods of time than it was in that first heat wave. So you can see right there, if you look at the tracker, how our bodies are acclimating, and the heat waves that were occurring later in the summer were not sending as many people to the hospital as the earlier one that caught us all off guard and our bodies like unacclimated.
First,
I want to
heat
talk
wave
more about application. Sorry, Molly, I want to bring in Peter McGuire here before we've got to fit in lots of folks here, and we'll get back to your thought. We want to bring in Peter McGuire, our colleague and Maine Public's climate reporter. Also, Peter, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Yeah. So one thing you reported on was how these extremely hot events aren't thought of in the same way that we think of, you know, a hurricane or a wildfire, a thing that happened that we need to pay attention to that's very dramatic. What in the course of your reporting, what did you find out about maybe how we might adjust our thinking on that or how we do think about that?
Yeah. I mean, heat waves are easily the deadliest form of extreme weather, but we don't really think about them in the same way. And a lot of that has to do with they kind of happen silently and they happen really quietly. There aren't huge swaths of destruction. You know, there isn't a recovery effort afterwards. You know, there isn't, you know, federal money deployed to help people rebuild. And so it's really the people I talk to in my reporting were talking about thinking about it differently and thinking about it in a cost of human lives rather than in the typical way that we think about a natural disaster. So I think that's part of it. It's just kind of you have to bend your mind a little bit to expect them to be as dangerous as like you mentioned, a hurricane or something like that.
You also reported on how heat affects people in the workplace. I always think of, you know, roofers in Augusta and I mean in August rather, and wonder, you know, how they do that. What kinds what did you find in your reporting about workers who are most affected by these heat events and the risks that they face?
Yeah, and absolutely. I think Rebecca can speak to this maybe more eloquently than I can. But I think it's, you know, pretty much anybody who works outside, you know, that's where you're going to feel the brunt of heat waves, of very hot days. But, you know, there's indoor spaces, too, that can be dangerous. I think warehouses are kind of a surprising one. They're really hard to keep cool. And people are doing a lot of physical labor inside. Obviously, commercial kitchens, just places where it's really hot. You know, paper mills, for example, in Maine have had kind of cooling protocols on the books for a long time because it is so dangerous to work in some of those environments.
And are there regulations to protect workers from these heat events as a matter of safety?
Yeah, not specifically. So there's, as an employer, you kind of have a general duty of care to your employees. So you need to keep them safe, but there's no specific regulations having to do with heat. And during the Biden administration, that there was a proposal that was being circulated that would, you know, put in things like mandatory rest breaks, water, shade, things of that nature, kind of like physical checks on workers. When, you know, the heat index would reach, I think, 80 degrees, which is a lot lower than you would expect. But that's at the point where it's really dangerous. And I think it surprised a lot of people that rule, as far as I'm aware, is still kind of going forward. They finished public hearings, and we'll see where that goes.
All right. Peter, thank you so much. Thanks for joining us. Peter McGuire, climate reporter for Maine Public. And we're going to take a quick break. You can give us a call. The number is 1-800-399-3566. That's 800-399-3566. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Keith Shortall. Periods of extreme heat are dangerous for people and animals and affect the environment. The repercussions of hot temperatures in Maine also affect the economy. We're learning about a series of Maine Public and Portland Press Herald stories that called attention to the impacts of heat in Maine. My guests, Rebecca Lincoln, epidemiologist with the Maine CDC, and climate reporters Penny Overton with the Press Herald and Molly Enking with Maine Public. We invite you to join the conversation. What effects has the extreme heat been on you in your part of the state? You can email us at talk@mainpublic.org, comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. Molly, I wanted to just ask you, we were talking before the break with Peter about jobs that people who are affected in the workplace, and I think you did some work with solar installers or some reporting on solar installers?
Oh, yes. I was at the State House this summer in Augusta for, I guess, something unrelated. But in the course of that reporting, I got to talk to a lot of solar installers that day. And naturally, because heat was on my mind for this project, I was asking them about what installing solar panels, what that's like in the summertime. And, you know, their descriptions were vivid. They've really stayed with me ever since. You know, if you can imagine, these solar panels are designed to absorb the power of the sun. So they're out there on a 90 degree day, handling these reflective, you know, big metal and glass panels. And they were saying, you know, standing next to one of those panels, maybe it's 90 degrees outside, but it suddenly feels like it's 105. And some of the folks I spoke to, you know, said that without even asking, their union reps had arranged for them to have cooling areas to go into, but they weren't sure that those protections extended to non-union contractors working in solar panel development. By contrast, that same morning, this was during the June heat wave, I had been outside briefly in my neighborhood, walked past a couple construction workers who were laying brick on a broken sidewalk. And I just happened to ask them if they had any cooling options, and they pointed to their truck and they said, yeah, just get in the truck and idle and turn the air conditioning on and drink Gatorade out of the cooler. So I think the options for cooling sort of run the gamut. I know we'll hear more about that from Patty White later. The other thing I wanted to quickly add to Peter's section was in the course of our reporting, we discovered that some places have adopted this new practice of naming heat waves. So, you know, names like Hurricane Katrina and Ida, they immediately trigger memories of those disasters, right? Like, I'm never going to forget what Hurricane Katrina was. And a town, I think it was Seville in Spain, practiced what it would be like to name a heat wave. And studies show that people took the heat wave more seriously and took more precautions. It's still a little controversial. People are unsure about naming heat waves just because it's a new practice. They're worried it would cause confusion. But some early studies are showing that it is effective for getting people to take heat waves more seriously.
Let's bring in Patty White, our health reporter here at Maine Public. And Patty, I think you're there. Hello?
Yeah. Hi, Keith.
Yes. Hey, Patty. So I just want to make sure you're indicated that you're on, but you never know sometimes. So you looked at cooling centers, as I guess they're called. And, you know, we as reporters often, as a public service, will say during a heat wave, we'll let the public know that there's a cooling center open here or there for those who need it. What did you find in your reporting as to the role that these play and, you know, whether they're being used and are able to do what they intend to do?
Sure. Yeah. So the way that cooling centers work, municipalities really decide whether or not to open a cooling center. And usually these are in existing places like a town hall or a local community center or a library. And many towns really are proactive about this. There's actually a statewide list on the Maine Emergency Management Agency website. Some cooling centers are listed all summer long, usually, you know, at places like libraries. Others are only listed on really hot days. And the idea is generally that these are comfortable places to stay for several hours. There's internet and computers, drinks, maybe even some food. And, you know, in terms of their use, I don't think anyone in the state is really tracking how many people actually visit them. And they may not get used a lot, but from what I understand from the people I spoke to, it's still really important that towns offer these. And it's for two reasons. One is so that towns are prepared if we have a really extreme heat wave. They already kind of know what to do. And also the second reason is so residents are familiar with, oh, these are the places that are available to me, even if they haven't gone to them in the past. Hopefully they hear about them or just know about them so that when they decide they need to use them, they know where to go.
You also reported on sporting events and the effects that sporting events during hotter periods. And I think you went to the Beach to Beacon race, for example. What did you find out about how the staff there was prepared to treat athletes who develop specifically heat stroke?
You know, it was really interesting to see. I mean, what I found out was that there is a lot of heat illness that happens at summer road races. It's a combination of heat and exertion that just can really fuel heat exhaustion and then even heat stroke, which can be life-threatening. So at the Beach to Beacon, they have a medical tent set up knowing that they're going to treat a lot of runners with heat stroke. They have a bunch of Rubbermaid tubs, the kind that you use on farms to feed or give water to animals. They're filled with water with bags of ice nearby. And then a bunch of volunteers fan out during the race. They watch runners, and they're especially watching runners as they cross the finish line to see if anyone looks like they're in trouble. And if they suspect someone has heat illness, they bring them into the tent, they check their core temperature, and if it's 104 degrees or higher, then into the ice bath they go. But what's kind of interesting, you know, with heat stroke, it can alter your mental state. So these patients are not always the easiest to deal with. And some of the volunteers talked about how they've been bitten or kicked. They had a runner one year who faked them out and tried to get up and run away from the ice tub. But it's all a function of just having this really serious heat illness. And the reason why it's important to be set up at the race is that you have to treat heat stroke very quickly, and there just isn't enough time to bring runners to a hospital emergency room. And also, hospital emergency rooms are not set up to treat a bunch of people all at once who need an ice bath. They don't have ice baths ready to go. So at the Beach to Beacon, they have a bunch of them and they use them.
Yeah, I was going to say, with the stress that hospitals are under, probably multiple ice baths is not on the list. Patty, thank you so much for joining us and for your reporting. I want to ask Rebecca Lincoln, you're hearing more themes here about public awareness and public health around really the seriousness of a condition like heat stroke. A lot of people are running, doing 10Ks. Is that one of the things that keeps you up at night? Is that, you know, that public awareness is not where it needs to be around the real danger of extreme heat?
Definitely. I mean, I think, you know, I heard a couple of things from Patty that really struck me as consistent with what we think about and hear and sort of, you know, the lack of awareness more generally around heat as a problem we worry about all the time for all sorts of reasons with all sorts of groups. Folks that are out exerting themselves on hot summer days and especially the cognitive changes that you can experience when you're starting to suffer from a heat illness really get in the way of people recognizing that they're having a problem and doing something about it. And so I think there's a really insidious quality to a heat-related illnesses like heat exhaustion and heat stroke that prevent people from getting it under control, recognizing that they're more than just regular hot, they're dangerously hot and they need help. We worry about that a lot. And I think education and, you know, getting people used to the idea of heat as a public health issue here in Maine, as a health thing they need to take seriously, takes us in the right direction. The more we talk about this, the more we raise awareness for folks that are going to be exposed to it, whether they're running a race or at the beach all day or working in the heat, like we heard from Peter. We worry about those workers too, recognizing that they need to take it seriously and having the opportunity and the resources to protect themselves.
Yeah, the warming climate has effects, of course, well beyond road race runners and workers, and affects really much of our lives. We're going to bring now in senior ocean scientist Susie Arnold with the Island Institute. Susie, welcome.
Thank you.
So, we have all heard, I think, by now, much attention being paid to the fact that the waters off the coast of Maine are among the fastest warming in the world. What is the, I know this is a big question, but from 10,000 feet, what has this meant for the marine ecosystem in the Gulf of Maine?
Sure. So like we've been talking about, we've broke a lot of heat records on land in Maine. We've also done similar things within the Gulf of Maine, particularly over the last 15 years. But I would say as far as impacts on species that are iconic to the state, like our groundfish, including cod and haddock and pollock and flounder, those species are very temperature sensitive and prefer colder water temperatures. Similarly, lobsters have a fairly narrow thermal tolerance. So as water temperatures in the Northwest Atlantic are increasing, you can see why lobsters don't do so well in southern New England anymore. There used to be a robust lobster fishery there. As waters have warmed, that's no longer the case. So, you know, some marine species are mobile and they can swim to different habitats, and some are literally stuck in the mud where they have to handle the habitat that they're kind of stuck in.
There was this then a strange twist last year when scientists noticed cold waters coming in deep through the Gulf of Maine. explain that phenomenon and what it means for this trend of warming waters.
That's exactly right. So that trend was actually first brought to scientists' attention by fishermen who observed that deep water cooling that was pretty peculiar given the rate of warming that we've seen. So really like late 2023, we started to notice cooler temperatures at depths in the Gulf of Maine. And scientists think that this has to do with the variability of contributions of a couple major ocean currents. So you can think of the Gulf Stream as kind of the warm faucet, and that's offshore the Gulf of Maine. And then you have the cold water faucet, which is the Labrador Current coming down from Canada. So that's the cold water faucet. And over the last several decades, we've seen kind of an influx in warm water coming into the Northeast Channel from that warm water faucet, the Gulf Stream. And what we think is happening is the Gulf Stream is kind of migrating more offshore, allowing that cold water faucet to enter through the Northeast Channel at depth, bringing those cold waters into the Gulf of Maine. It's unclear how long that shift will happen, but there has definitely been a couple years of pause in this rapid warming that we've seen for the last couple decades.
When we're talking about this sort of thing and covering it, there may be a sense that it's overwhelming and foreboding, but also inevitable that what's going to happen is going to happen. Do you see it that way?
Not really. I mean, I think, you know, we've definitely seen and acknowledged that climate impacts are having a toll on people's mental health in Maine and globally. And, you know, working in the field, what I've seen here in the state is that people are responding. We're really leading the way on climate action. I think in Maine here, we're fortunate to have a lot of shared values around valuing the environment and valuing the natural resources that our state depends on. And so, you know, there's a big link between social connectivity and hope. And so, you know, they say the biggest predictor of hope is being connected. And I think, you know, we're really fortunate to live in a friendly state, a connected place with a strong sense of community. And I think that connectivity and kind of a can-do attitude of people in Maine puts us in a better place to adapt to this rapid change that we're seeing.
Thank you so much, Susie Arnold, Senior Ocean Scientist with the Island Institute. I want to bring in Quilla, who is calling from Bangor. Hi, Quilla. Welcome to the program.
Oh, hi.
Hi, go ahead, please.
Hello? Yeah. Oh, thank
yes,
you.
Go ahead.
Sorry.
Yep.
I meant to send a message in on Facebook. I just wanted to say the humidity is very high here in Maine, and in fact, on the East Coast, it's, you know, the history of it is kind of swampy. And so, anyways, I was visiting Southern California back about 10 years ago, sitting in my car, had the windows down, the breeze was going. Mind you, I was in the shade, and I was thinking it was a nice, lovely 75 degrees out, and the DJ came on the radio and said, it's 94 out and blah, blah, this. And I was in shock. I just couldn't believe it. I'm a very heavily sweaty person, and I have a physically labor-intensive job. So I am just absolutely miserable on warm days when the humidity is 60% or above and the dew point is usually kind of high. I'm actually relocating to the Midwest, where although it's warmer, my sweat glands allow for evaporative cooling to take place, and I can actually live and work comfortably and happily. It's just that part of the equation does make the heat that much more oppressive. So I love the state of Maine, and I hate to leave, but I really can't exist happily here. And it's very sad to me. But, a year ago, like I lead out of Maine, you know, I have to leave the state. So anyways, just wanted to put my two cents in. Thank you for taking my call.
All right, Quilla, thank you. We have to take a break here in a moment, but any thoughts about Quilla relocating
because Quilla, of the humidity? I'm so sorry you're leaving the state of Maine. We'll miss you. I agree. We can talk about this after the break, but wet, bold temperature, which I can explain, that keeps me up at night too, and the heat index. So we'll talk humidity.
We'll talk about that. We'll take this quick break. And the phone number, again, to join is 1-800-399-3566. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Keith Shortall. Why is hot weather a growing problem in a traditionally cold state like Maine? That's a question that prompted our recent reporting series, Heat in Maine. Joining me to talk about that, climate reporters Penny Overton with the Portland Press Herald, and Molly Enking with Maine Public, and Rebecca Lincoln with the Maine CDC. Join the conversation, email talk@mainepublic.org. You can also post on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. Molly, we heard from Quilla before the break who had decided to leave Maine for other less humid climes. You wanted to add something.
Oh, yeah. I think Quilla brings up an important point. People always, you know, you hear the phrase, it's not the heat, it's the humidity. That's a partly valid phrase, but it's actually both. The heat index, which is also known as apparent temperature, is what temperature feels like to the human body when humidity is combined with temperature. Another term that I learned in this terrifying chapter of a book called The Ministry for the Future, which I do recommend to everyone, it's by Kim Stanley Robinson. Wet bulb temperature is, there's basically a point where being wet or being in the water won't cool you down anymore because there's too much humidity in the air for moisture to evaporate off of your body. Rebecca, you were talking earlier about things that keep you up at night. I think when I learned about that through this fictional book about climate change that I mentioned, that concept was so terrifying. It still lives rent-free in my mind today. Yeah. I'm from Maine originally, so the humidity doesn't bother me, but to each their own.
Right. I've visited Washington, D.C. in the summer, and I think there's nothing more challenging than that. But
sure.
In terms of humidity. we're joined now by Daniel Kuhl, the utilities reporter for the Portland Press Herald. I think we're joined by him. Let's see. Try again. Daniel, hi, welcome to the program. Sorry about that.
Hi there. Thanks for having me. All good.
So we've talked about a lot of areas that that heat has affected. You looked at how these heat events affect business in your reporting, and you found that that particularly those businesses that have to keep either people cool or goods cool were particularly affected. Could you talk about that?
Absolutely. I think it comes as no surprise to folks living in Maine that electricity costs here are sort of a major part of anybody's bottom line, whether you're a household or, you know, a big business. But where this becomes a little more pointed is places like grocery stores, food banks, museums, where, for example, like their temperature and the humidity impacts the ability to preserve the collections. These places have to be running their heating and cooling systems, particularly their cooling systems, at all hours of the day, regardless of any sort of changes in demand or any other changes to other costs. So these sort of ever-climbing electricity prices that we grapple with here in Maine are a particular concern for those folks.
We have a note from a listener who points out also that there are infrastructure costs for electricity related to intense storms, but that wasn't in your realm, but it is another energy cost.
Absolutely.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, we're seeing, you know, right now there's a big rate case going on with Central Maine Power that's sort of closely tied to some of these storm costs. And that's an important part of the question here, because a lot of these bigger businesses are able to secure special contracts to sort of nail down or make more regular the cost of the electricity itself. but they're still subject to these changing distribution costs that are more tied to the infrastructure and some of the storm side of things.
And summer is the time when these heat events happen, obviously, which is also prime tourist season, and which is, you know, except for Quilla, who is leaving, most people come here to find respite from other places that are hotter, and it's kind of an oasis for folks. So how have tourist-related businesses been affected by these spells?
It's sort of across the board. I was surprised to hear from folks in the hospitality industry that, you know, for the most part, while this is hot for Maine, if we have tourists who are coming from the American South or coming from elsewhere, I mean, Maine's hot day is not the same as, say, Louisiana or Texas's hot day. And people coming up here, tourists, you know, they might be sort of braving the heat, but it still is relatively better off. And people might be expecting, when they stay at a nice cottage, a bit more of a rustic environment. Something that really sort of jumped out at me, though, with the heat side of tourism is places like museums or movie theaters or other sort of indoor attractions. They see, as you might expect, demand fall when days become really nice and people are going out to the beach. But there's also this sort of extreme case for when the heats get up into the high 80s or the, you know, past 90, people stop being as inclined to spend time outside, and suddenly the demand for indoor activities sort of creeps back up. But anything, you know, up until that, these businesses are paying for more cooling, even though they're not seeing that change in demand, or at least that positive change in demand.
Daniel Kuhl, thank you so much. Daniel Kuhl, interesting name, of course, for the topic we're discussing today, but I'm sure you hear that far too often. Daniel Kuhl, a reporter for the Press Herald, who contributed to this heat series. I'll bring in now Alan from Winterport. Hi, Alan. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Yes, I tuned in late, so I'm not sure if you discussed this earlier, but I have a friend who was the occupational safety person for LIUNA, the International Union in D.C. I agree with you. It's a very miserable place to live. That's why I'm here instead of there. But the heat standard has been delayed and delayed and delayed, even through the Biden administration, from OSHA, and I think it's probably been just totally tabled in this administration. Maybe someone knows. My friend Scott is working on the Maryland heat standard for the state of Maryland, because they didn't have one in OSHA that was useful at all, or if they had one, it was very outdated. But I'm concerned about the whole deregulation thing that's happening in Washington. And it's going to be workers who are going to suffer for this, whether they're working on a farm situation or in a construction site. And I just wondered what your panel knows about what's happening at the federal level.
Alan, thank you.
I'll jump in there, actually, although I'm sure that Pete would probably have been able to respond to this a little better, since that was kind of one of his focus. But I know that everyone had assumed, given some of the things that President Trump had tweeted about deregulating and kind of clearing the path for business, that this would actually get the heat standard proposed under the Biden administration would get killed. But it's actually still alive. And, you know, it has not moved into the phase where they're actually starting implementation, but it has not been killed. You know, stay tuned to see what happens with that. But there have been a lot of other programs that have been stopped, you know, on a dime, and this one is not one of them. So I will say that that's actually a good kind of segue into talking about a little bit of the regulatory issues here in Maine, because I think it's also interesting that Maine has had kind of a mixed bag of opportunities where they could have established heat ranges or thermal protections in certain parts of, you know, whether it be in schools or if it was in nursing homes or actually with energy costs, there was sometimes we'll have an opportunity to set maximum temperature ranges, and lawmakers will decide, you know what, we're a cold weather state, we don't really need to do that. But, and so it's a perception that's still out there and affecting the way that we regulate. And in other cases, we've had people jump in and say, no, we can't allow, for example, utilities to do cutoffs anymore during a heat wave, the same way that traditionally we prevented cutoffs of service for delinquent taxpayer or delinquent ratepayers during the winter time. So there have been like areas where we've been really progressive on heat and areas where we've been kind of regulatory a little behind.
Yeah. Molly, I wanted to ask you also about your coverage of heat in schools. That was one of your focuses. And you found, well, I don't characterize what you found. You can tell us. What was your biggest takeaway as you looked at schools, particularly in the shoulder seasons, you know, when it's warm in the spring and in the fall?
Yeah. So as we talked about earlier on the program, you know, many Maine buildings are older, and that includes schools. They're designed to hold in the heat during harsh winters, not to provide air circulation or cooling. And I believe the impetus for the story was my colleague Pete and I taking a look at the 2025 Maine School Building Inventory Report, where we saw that around a quarter of Maine schools don't have any air conditioning at all. And only 15% have it in the majority of rooms in the school. So when they do have AC, it's often limited to like a handful of administrative offices or maybe like just in the gym or just in the library. So looking into this more, it seems like, you know, it sort of runs the gamut across the state, but school administrators do know this is a problem. Some of them have the ability and the funding to address it now. Some of them sort of have to do it piecemeal over time. A lot of teachers have found workarounds. So a couple teachers I was speaking to for the story, notably one science teacher had just reprogrammed her entire curriculum for the school year and was like, okay, I know in the shoulder season, it's going to be hot. I'd rather just do all my outdoor lessons in September and May and the tail end of June, because it's going to be better outside than on the second floor of our building. So that's the reality. Other teachers talk about bringing in box fans from home, you know, just reminding their kids to sip water every 15 minutes, getting headaches from, you know, just facing the extreme heat throughout the day in these buildings. There was some legislation that passed just this past session to require school districts to set indoor temperature standards for schools. There haven't been any yet, but there's no time limit on that. And there are no current specific guidelines from the DOE, just sort of a guideline about comfortable temperatures. So it's a first step. And I think it's something that is a continuing conversation among school districts.
Yeah, Rebecca?
I'd love to jump on that, if I may, and say one of my favorite things about Molly's story covering schools, which is an area that we think about a lot too. The shoulder seasons have been on our radar for a while, and it was really wonderful to read the section at the end of the story, you know, detailing how the Windham Raymond School District has, you know, heat pumps now installed that are keeping indoor climates in those shoulder seasons much more comfortable and, you know, optimal for learning, and what a better experience the teachers and the students were having in terms of their learning and their health was great to see. But I think the piece, you know, that we can't fix as easily is the outdoor environment for students, and in particular school sports. We worry a lot about these late summer heat waves when like sports seasons are getting underway, when practices have begun, and thinking a lot about how to ensure that school districts, administrators, athletic directors have resources and training for their coaches and their students about exertional heat stress, and, you know, preventing those heat stroke cases in their student athletes as well is really important.
So we only have a few seconds left. Go ahead.
Sure. I just want to make a quick point about AC, which is that the environment is the irony is that the more we need to cool spaces, the more we heat the planet. Adaptation is important, and protecting human health is the most important thing, but cooling is also a big contributor to global warming. So it is sort of a cycle when we talk about, you know, the solution of adding air conditioning. That's something we could probably do a whole nother show on.
yeah, another thing to keep us up at night. Thank mm-hmm. you all for joining us today. We could go on forever, but we can't. So thank you. Molly Enking, Maine Public's climate editor, check out her Planet Maine climate newsletter. Penelope Overton is the Portland Press Herald's climate reporter, and Rebecca Lincoln is an environmental epidemiologist with the Maine CDC. Look for the Heat in Maine reporting by going to mainepublic.org. Today's sound engineer was Jess Miller. Our theme music was composed by Mike Jandro. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. I'm Keith Shortall. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.